He fixed his gaze out through the archway, which opened upon the loveliest prospect he had ever beheld. The sun still low in the sky beyond the falls, newly risen, and glowing small and molten through the gusting clouds of mist. The torrents of water, churned to pure white, were roaring steadily over the verge, the tangled branches of trees yearning out towards the water from the canyon walls where they had taken root, the gauzy, insubstantial suggestion of a rainbow, which refused to be seen head-on, but clung to the edge of his vision. His shoulders ached as they drew him taut. He had seen men take a dozen lashes without a sound, foremast hands under his very own orders, he reminded himself after every stroke. By the tenth, however, the argument lost its potency, and he was only trying raggedly to endure, in an animal sort of way, the pain which no longer ceased between the strokes, but only ebbed and flowed. The whip struck awry once. The man holding his right arm cursed, the edge of his hand having been caught by the lash, by the sound of it, and yelled a complaint at the flogger, good-natured. The whip did not cut the skin, but the wheels broke after some time. Blood ran down over his ribs. Lawrence was not precisely insensible when another dragon returned him to the cave, only very far away, his throat raw and stretched to ruin. He was grateful for it, or would have been, otherwise he would have screamed again when they put hands on him to lift him face downwards onto the ground, even though they did not touch his torn back. Every nerve had been woken to pain. Sleep did not come, only a kind of murky absence of thought which darkened by degrees into unconsciousness. Water was put to his lips. With sharp authority, Dorset ordered him to drink. The habit of obedience carried Lawrence through the effort. He faded again, and for a long time a grey heat stifled him. He thought perhaps he drank a little more, and another time dreamt his mouth was welling up with salty blood, and choking, half woke to Dorset, squeezing cold broth into his mouth from a rag, before again he slept and wandered in fever dreams.
"Lawrence, Lawrence," Temeraire said, through the haze, in a strange, hollow voice, and Ferris was hissing in his ear, saying, "Captain, you must wake up, you must, he thinks you're dead."
His voice was full of so much fear that Lawrence tried to speak to comfort him, although his mouth would not quite form words properly. Then the dream fell away again into a terrible roaring. He felt as though the earth shook. Then all gone into a comfortable darkness. Chapter 12. The next he knew of the world was a cup of clean water held for him by Emily Rowland. Dorset was kneeling on the floor beside him and bracing him up by the waist. Lawrence managed to put a hand around the cup and guide it to his mouth, spilling a little. He was palsied as an old man and trembling. He was lying on his stomach on a thin pallet of gathered straw covered with shirts, bare to the chest himself, and he was desperately hungry.
"A little at a time," Dorset said, giving him small round balls of cooled porridge one after another.
They had eased him onto his side to eat.
"Temeraire,"
Lawrence said, around an involuntary and desperate gluttony, wondering if he had only dreamed. He could not move his arms freely, his back had scabbed over, but if he reached too far forward the edges split, fresh blood trickling down the skin. Dorset did not at once answer.
"Was he here?"
Lawrence said sharply.
"Lawrence,"
Harcourt said, kneeling down by him.
"Lawrence, pray do not get distressed. You have been ill a week. He was here, but I am afraid they ran him off. I am sure he is quite well."
"Enough. You must sleep," Dorset said, and for all the will in the world, Lawrence could not resist the command. He was already fading again. When he woke, it was daylight outside and the cavern nearly empty, except for Rowland and Dyer and Took.
"They take the others to work, sir, in the fields," she said.
They gave him a little water, and reluctantly, at his insistence, the support of their shoulders, so he might stagger to the edge of the cave and look outside. The cliff face opposite was cracked, and the dark stains of dragon blood looked deep burnt orange-red on the striated walls.
"It is not his, sir."
"Or not much," Emily said anxiously, looking up at him. She could tell him nothing more, not how Temeraire had found them, nor if he had been quite alone, nor his condition. There had been no time for conversation. With a number of dragons flying at all hours through the gorges, Temeraire had passed for a few moments as one in the throng, but he was too large and remarkably coloured to escape notice, and when he had put his head into the cave to see them, he had at once raised an alarm. Temeraire had penetrated so far only because their captors evidently did not anticipate an incursion of dragons so deep into their stronghold. But there was a guard now, newly stationed above their cell. Lawrence could see its tail hanging down from the top of the cliff, if he painfully turned his neck, as far as he could, to look directly upwards. "And I expect that means he got clear away from them," Chenery said comfortingly, when the others had been returned late in the afternoon. "He can fly rings around half the core, Lawrence. I'm sure he gave them the slip." Lawrence would have liked to believe it more than he did. 3 days had gone by since that delirious state had broken, and if Temeraire had been able, Lawrence knew very well he would have made another attempt in the teeth of any opposition. Perhaps had, and out of their sight had been injured again, or worse. Lawrence was not taken the next morning with the others. They had been set along with the other prisoners of war to working in the elephant fields, spreading the manure, much to the satisfaction of the young women to whom the work ordinarily fell.
"Nonsense! I would be perfectly ashamed if I could not manage it," Catherine said. "When all those girls do, a good many of them are further along than I am, and it is not as though I have not been brought up to work. Besides, I am perfectly stout. Indeed, I am much better than I was. But you have been very sick, Lawrence, and you are to listen to Dr. Dorset and stay lying down when they come."
She was very firm, and Dorset also. But they had been gone a little more than an hour when another dragon came for Lawrence, the rider issuing peremptory commands and beckoning. Roland and Dyer were ready to back him into the depths of the cave, but the dragon was a smallish creature, not much bigger than a courier, and could easily have put himself inside. Lawrence struggled to his feet, and for decency's sake took one of the sweat-and-blood-stained shirts which had helped make up his pallet to cover himself, if he was not truly fit to be seen. He was carried back to the great hall. The king was not there, but the ironworks were in full swing under the supervision of Prince Moshweshwe. The smiths were engaged in pouring bullets, with the help of another dragon who nursed their forge regularly with narrow-breathed tongues of flame, rousing the coals within to a fever pitch of heat. They had somehow acquired several bullet moulds, and there were still more muskets stacked upon the floor, if marked here and there with bloody fingerprints. The room was sweltering, even with a couple of smaller dragons fanning away vigorously to make the air move, but the prince looked satisfied. He took Lawrence back towards the map again. It had been already a little improved, and an entirely new addition made to the west. A vague distance allowed for the Atlantic, and then the approximate shapes of the American continents drawn out. The great harbour of Rio most prominently marked, and the islands of the West Indies placed a little tentatively somewhere to the north. There was none of the exactness needed to make it of practical use for navigation, Lawrence was glad to see. He was far from that earlier complacency during their abduction, which had dismissed their captors as a threat against the colony itself. There were too many dragons here. Mrs. Erasmus had also been brought, and Lawrence braced himself for a further interrogation, to which he would not allow himself to feel unequal. But Moshweshwe did not repeat the king's demands or his violence. His servants instead gave Lawrence a drink, oddly sweet, of pressed fruits and water and coconut milk, and his questions were of generalities and trade, wide-ranging. He had a bolt of cloth to show Lawrence, calico-patterned and certainly from the mills of England. Some bottles of whisky, unpleasantly harsh and cheap by the smell, also of foreign manufacture.
"You sell these things to the Lunda," Moshweshwe said, "and those also," indicating the muskets.
"They have lately fought a war against them," Mrs. Erasmus said, quickly adding her own explanation at the tail of the translation. There had been a battle won 2 days' flight from the falls. "North-west, I think," she said, and asked Moshweshwe permission to show him the territory on the great map of the continent. North-west, and still deep inland, but in a few days' striking distance of the ports of Luanda and Benguela.
"Sir," Lawrence said, "I have never heard of Lunda before 2 weeks ago. I believe they must have these goods from perhaps the Portuguese traders upon the coast. And do you only want captives, or will you take other things in trade? The medicines you stole, or and one of the women carried over at Mushweshwe's beckoning a box of jewels,
absurdly magnificent, which would have made the Nizam stare. Polished emeralds tumbled like marbles with diamonds, and the box itself of gold and silver.
Another carried over carefully a tall, curious vase made of woven wire strung occasionally with beads, in an elaborate pattern without figures, and another an enormous mask, nearly tall as she herself was, carved of dark wood inlaid with ivory and jewels. Lawrence wondered a little if this were meant for another sort of inducement.
"A trader would oblige you, sir, I am sure. I am not a merchant myself. We would be glad, would have been glad, to pay you for the medicines in what barter you desired."
Mushweshwe nodded, and the treasure was taken away.
"And the canon?"
He used the English word himself with tolerable pronunciation.
"Or your boats which cross the ocean?"
There were enough jewels in the box to have tolerably purchased and outfitted a fleet of merchantmen, Lawrence would have guessed, but he did not think the government would be very pleased to see such a project go forward. He answered cautiously,
"These are dearer, sir, for the difficulty of their construction, and would do you very little good without the men who understand their operation. But some men might be found willing to take service with you, and such an arrangement made possible, if there were peace between our countries."
Lawrence thought this was not further than he could in justice go, and as much attempt at diplomacy as he knew how to make. He hoped, as a hint, it would not be badly received. Moshweshwe's intentions were not disguised. It was not wonderful that he, more than the king, should have taken to heart the advantages of modern weaponry, more easily grasped at musket scale by men than by dragons, and should have cared to establish access to them. Mushweshwe put his hand on the map-table and gazed thoughtfully down upon it. At last he said,
"You are not engaged in this trade, you say, but others of your tribe are. Can you tell me who they are, and where they may be found?"
"Sir, I am sorry to say that there are too many engaged in the trade for me to know their names or particulars," Lawrence said awkwardly, and wished bitterly that he might have been able to say with honesty it had been lately banned. Instead, he could only add that he believed it soon would be, which was received with as much satisfaction as he had expected.
"We will ban it ourselves," the prince said,
the more ominously for the lack of any deliberately threatening tone.
"But that will not satisfy our ancestors."
He paused.
"You are Kafensi's captives. He wants to trade you for more of his tribe. Can you arrange such an exchange? Lethabo says you cannot."
"I have told them that most of the others cannot be found," Mrs. Erasmus added quietly. "It was nearly 20 years ago."
"Perhaps some investigation could locate the survivors," Lawrence said to her doubtfully. "There would be bills of sale, and I suppose some of them must yet be on the same estates where they first were sold. You do not think so?" She said after a moment,
"I was taken into the house when I was sold. Those in the fields did not live long, most of them. A few years, maybe 10. There were not many old slaves."
Lawrence did not quarrel with her finality, and he thought she did not translate her own words either, likely to shield him from the rage which they could provoke. She said enough to convince Mushweshwe of the impossibility, however, and he shook his head.
"However," Lawrence said, trying, "we would be glad to ransom ourselves if you would arrange a communication with our fellows at the Cape, and to carry an envoy with us to England to establish peaceful relations. I would give my own word to do whatever could be done to restore his kin."
"No," Mushweshwe said, "there is nothing I can do with this, not now. The ancestors are too roused up. It is not Kafense only who has been bereft, and even those who have not lost children of their own are angry. My father's temper was not long when he was a man, and it is shorter since his change of life. Perhaps after."
He did not say, after what, but issued orders to the attending dragons. Without a chance to speak, Lawrence was snatched up and carried out at once. The dragon did not turn back for the prison cave, however, but turned instead for the falls, rising up out of the gorge and to the level of the plateau across which the great river flowed. Lawrence clung to the basketing talons as they flew along its banks and over another of the great elephant herds, too quickly for him to recognize if any of his compatriots were among the followers tending the ground,
and to a distance at which the sound of the falls was muted, although the fine cloud of smoke yet remained visible, hovering perpetual in place to mark their location. There were no roads below at all, but at regular intervals Lawrence began to notice cairns of stones, in circles of cleared ground which might have served as signposts. And they had flown 10 minutes when there came rearing up before them a vast amphitheatre. It was near to nothing in his own experience but the Colosseum in Rome, built entirely of blocks of stone fitted so snugly that no mortar, visibly, held them together. The outer enclosure was built in an oval shape, with no entrances but a few at the base, formed with great overlapping slabs of stone laid one against another, like the old stone circles in England. It stood in the middle of a grassy field, undisturbed, as he would have expected from some ancient, unused ruin. Only a few faintly worn tracks showed where men had come into the entries on foot, mostly from the river, where stakes had been driven in the ground, and a few simple boats were tied up. But they flew in directly over the walls, and there were no signs of disuse within. The same dry-mortar method of construction had raised a series of terraces, topped and levelled out with more stone slabs laid flat and irregularly arranged. Instead of even tiers, narrow stairways divided the theatre into sections, each a haphazard arrangement of boxes intended for human use, and filled with wooden benches and stools, some beautifully carved, and large stalls surrounding them for dragons. The higher levels simplified further into wide-open stands with sections marked off only with rope. At the centre of it all, a large grassy oval stood bare, broken up with three large stone platforms, and on the last of these, a prisoner with drooping head, was Temeraire. Lawrence was set down a few lengths away with the usual carelessness, jarring his back sorely. At his repressed gasp, Temeraire growled, a deep and queerly stifled noise. He had been muzzled with a piece of dreadful iron basketry secured upon his head with many thick leather straps which allowed his jaws a scant range of motion, not enough to roar. A thick iron collar around his throat at the top of his neck was leashed with three of the massive grey hawsers which Lawrence could now see were made of braided wire rather than rope. These were fixed to iron rings set in the ground, equidistant from one another and preventing Temeraire from throwing his weight against any one of them more than the others.
"Lawrence! Lawrence!" Temeraire said, straining his head towards him with all the inches the cables would yield.
Lawrence would have gone to him at once, but the dragon which had brought him set its foreleg down between them. He was not permitted.
"Pray do not hurt yourself, my dear. I am perfectly well,"
Lawrence called, forcing himself to straighten. He was anxious lest Temeraire should have done himself some mischief, flinging himself against the collar. It looked to be digging into the flesh.
"You are not very uncomfortable, I hope?"
"Oh, it is nothing," Temeraire said, panting with a distress which belied his words. "Nothing. Now I see you again. Only I could not move very much, and no one comes to talk to me, so I did not know anything, if you were well or hurt, and you were so strange when I saw you last."
He backed slowly and cautiously one pace and let himself down again, still breathing heavily, and gave his head a little shake, as much as the chains would allow, so they rang around him, like a horse in traces.
"And it makes eating a little difficult," he added bravely. "And water tastes of rust, but it does not signify. Are you sure you are well? You do not look well."
"I am, and very glad to see you," Lawrence said, businesslike,
though in truth he was at some pains to keep his feet.
"If beyond words with surprise. We were mortally certain we should never be found."
"Sutton said we would never find you by roaming wild about the continent," Temeraire said, low and angry, "and that we ought to go back to Cape Town. But I told him that was a very great piece of nonsense, for however unlikely we should find you looking in the interior, it was very much less likely we should find you back at the Cape. So we asked directions."
"Directions?" Lawrence said, baffled.
He had consulted with some of the local dragons, who, living farther to the south, had not been subject yet to the slave-raiding, and were not so disposed to be hostile.
"At least, not once we had made them a few presents of some particularly nice cows, which, I am sorry, Lawrence, we took quite without permission from some of the settlers, so I suppose we must pay them when we have got back to Cape Town,"
Temeraire added, as confidently as if nothing stood in the way of their return.
"It was a little difficult to make them understand what we wanted at first,
but some of them understood the Khoisa language, which I had got a little of from Damane and Sifo, and I have learnt a little of theirs as we came closer. It is not very difficult, and there are many bits which are like Durzak.
"But forgive me, I do not mean to be ungrateful," Lawrence said. "The mushrooms? What of the cure? Were there any left?"
"We had already given all those we collected to the Fiona," Temere said. "And if those were not enough, then Masoria and Immortalis could do very well taking back the rest without us," he finished defiantly. "So Saturn had no right to complain if we liked to go, and hang orders anyway."
Lawrence did not argue with him. He had no wish of giving any further distress. And in any case, Temeraire's insubordination having been answered by a success so improbable, he would certainly not be inclined to listen to any criticism on the subject. The sort of breakneck, reckless venture crowned inevitably, Lawrence supposed, by either triumph or disaster, speed and impudence having their own virtue.
"Where are Lily and Dulcia, then?"
"They are hiding out upon the plains," Temeraire said. "We agreed that first I should try, as I am big enough to carry you all, and then if anything should go wrong, they would still be loose."
He switched his tail with something halfway between irritation and unease.
"It made very good sense at the time, but I did not quite realize that anything would go wrong, and that I would not be able to help them plan," he added plaintively, "and now I do not know what they mean to do, although I am sure they will think of something."
But he sounded a little dubious.
As well he might. While they had been speaking, dragons had been coming in a steady stream, carrying in large woven baskets, or upon their backs men and women, and even children, and settling all down within the stands, a vast company, larger than Lawrence had yet suspected. The people arranged themselves in a hierarchy of wealth, those sitting on the lowest levels dressed in the most elaborate finery, panoply of furs and jewellery, in a splendid vulgar display. There was a great variety among the beasts in size and shape, and no sign of recognisable breeds, save perhaps a tendency towards similar colouring in those who sat near by one another, or in their pattern of markings. There was one constant, or nearly, however, the hostile looks which were bent upon Lawrence and Temeraire from all sides. Temeraire flared his ruff as best he could with the constricting straps, and muttered,
"They needn't all stare so. I think they are great cowards for keeping me chained."
Soldiers were being brought in now by dragons more armoured than ornamented, and many of them in blood-stained gear, no mark of slovenly habits but deliberate, worn proudly. Many of the stains were fresh as though they had come straight from the recent battle which Mrs. Erasmus had mentioned. These took up places around the floor of the great stadium in even ranks, while servants began to cover the large central stage with furs, lionskins and leopard, and similarly draped a wooden throne. Drums had been carried in, and Lawrence was thankful when they set up a great thunder and drew all eyes away. The king and the prince had arrived. The soldiers beat their short-hafted spears against the shields, and the dragons, roaring their own salute, set up a wave of rattling noise, on and on, while the royalty seated themselves upon the central dais. When they were settled, a small dragon, wearing an odd sort of necklace of fur tails around his neck, leapt up on his haunches beside the dais, and clearing his throat hushed the crowd with startling speed. His next deep breath was audible in the sudden silence, and then he launched himself into something between story and song, chanted and without rhyme to the beat of only one soft drum which kept time for him. Temeraire tilted his head to try and make it out, but when he looked at Lawrence and would have spoken, the dragon guarding them gave him a shocked glare even before a word had issued, which quelled him in embarrassment. Until with sunset the chant finished, and the raucous applause burst out again as torches were lit all around the dais. It had evidently been, from what Temeraire could gather, a kind of history of the deeds of the king and his ancestors, and more generally of the many assembled tribes, delivered entirely from memory, and covering some 7 generations. Lawrence could not help but feel the liveliest anxiety for the purpose of the convocation. The opening ceremonies thus completed, it proceeded swiftly to angry speeches, greeted with roaring approval, and again that thunder of spears against shields.
"That is not true at all," Temeraire said indignantly during one of these, having picked out a few of the words.
One highly decorated dragon, a grey-black fellow of middle-weight size, wearing a thick neck-collar of tiger furs banded with gold, had come and ranged himself opposite Temeraire, and was gesturing at him pointedly.
"I would not want your crew anyway. I have my own."
He and Lawrence were evidently figuring in most of these exhortations as material evidence to prove the existence of the threat and of its magnitude. Another dragon, very old, whose wing spurs dragged upon the ground and whose eyes were milky with cataracts, was led out into the field by a small escort of hard-faced men whose box, upon the lowest level, was left empty by their departure. They had no family with them. No one spoke as the dragon crept to the dais and heaved himself upon it. He raised his trembling head, his speech a thin and fragile lament which silenced all the crowd and made the women draw to them their children, the dragons curl anxious tails around the clustered knots of their nearest tribesmen. One of the escort wept silently, with his hand over his face, his fellows giving him the courtesy of pretending they did not see. When he had done and returned slowly to his place, several of the soldiers began to stand forward to make their remarks. One general, a heavy, barrel-chested gentleman, discarded his leopard-skin drape impatiently as he paced. With so much energy his skin gleamed in the torchlight with sweat, arguing vehemently in a voice projected to reach the highest tiers, gesturing at them at regular intervals, striking his fist into his hand, and pointing occasionally at Temeraire. Its speech roused them all not only to cheering but to agreement, grim nodding. He was warning them that many more such dragons would come if they did not take action now. The night dragged on, grim and long. When the children had all fallen into exhausted sleep, some of the dragons and the women carried them away. Those left kept speaking, climbing lower down in the stands as room opened, and voices grew more hoarse. Fatigue at last freed Lawrence from dread. They had not been stoned yet, nor offered any other violence but words, and his back throbbed and itched and burned, sapping the energy even to be afraid. It was still not easy to stand and be pilloried, even if Lawrence thankfully could escape the understanding of the better part of the accusations levelled against them. He solaced himself by keeping as straight as he could make himself, and fixing his gaze beyond the top ranks of the audience. But he was looking not to see, unfocused, so he did not immediately notice until a vigorous waving made him realize, with a start, that Dulcia was perched on the top rank of seats, now empty. She was small enough, and her green and mottled colouring sufficiently common to pass for one of the company, whose attention was in any case fixed upon the speakers. When she saw she had Lawrence's eyes, she sat up and held up in her forehands a ragged grey sheet. Lawrence had no notion what it was at first, and then realized it was an elephant hide, with three holes painstakingly sawed out of it in the shape of signal flags.
Tomorrow was all the message, and when he had seen it and nodded to her, she as quickly vanished away again into the dark.
"Oh, I hope they will come and let me loose first," Temeraire murmured, fretful at the prospect of a rescue in which he had no say. "There are so many dragons. I hope they will not do anything rash."
"Oh, I do too,"
Harcourt said anxiously, when Lawrence had been returned to them, well roasted and spat upon after the conclusion of the ceremonies. She went to the mouth of the cave at once to peer up at their sentinel. The dragon was slumped rather unhappily upon his ledge, with his head drooping down. In the distance the drums were still going in a celebration which bid fair to continue deep into the night. They could not prepare, save in the most general way, by drinking as much as they could hold, and washing up, but they all applied themselves to these tasks with more energy than they deserved.
"Bother, it is moving again,"
Harcourt said, as she squeezed out her wet hair, and she put her hand to the small of her back and rubbed. Inconveniently she had just begun to show. Her breeches were now obliged to be left open, and the sides held together over her middle with a bit of bark string left from their bindings. Her shirt was loose to cover the arrangement.
"Oh, if only it is a girl! I will never, never be so careless again."
By grace they slept well. The masons did not return to their work, perhaps given holiday, and so for once they were not woken with the dawn. No dragon came to carry any of them to the fields, although for an unpleasant balance, no dragon came to bring them any porridge either, so they would have to make their attempt empty-stomached. There were still a good many dragons flying back and forth through the gorges all day, but as evening fell their activity reduced, and the women went back early to their cavern halls, singing, with the baskets full of washing balanced upon their heads. Of course they had all expected the rescue to be made at night, rationally, but without certain knowledge the day was full of tension and constant anxiety, and the urge to be always looking out of the cavern mouth in a way which could only have roused suspicion. Sunset roused them all to feverish attention. No one spoke, all of them straining, until a little while after dark the heavy sailcloth flapping of Lily's enormous wings could be heard distantly on the quiet air. They all waited for the sound to approach more closely, to see her head in the cavern entrance, but it did not come. There was only a sneeze, and then another, and a third, concluded shortly with a sort of grumbling cough, and then the retreat of her wings. Lawrence looked at Catherine, perplexed, but she was edging towards the cave mouth, beckoning him and Chenery over, a faint sizzling noise, like bacon on a too-hot frying pan, a pinched, sharp, vinegared stink. There were a few pock marks bubbling on the floor near the cavern mouth.
"Look," Catherine said softly, "she has made us handholds,"
and she pointed where thin, smoky trails rose barely visible from the cliff face.
"Well, I dare say we can manage the climb, but what do we do when we're down?"
Chenery said, with more optimism than Lawrence felt. He had been made to go rock-climbing at Loch Laggan by the training master Celeritas, some 20 years past the time most aviators began the habit, and had learned thereby to manage upon a dragon's back without too much discredit to himself. But he remembered the experience, cramped, beetle-like, creeping one hand or foot at a time, without anything like pleasure, and there he had been wearing carabiners.
"If we walk along the line of the gorge, away from the falls, we are sure to get past the borders of their territory,"
Catherine said.
"The dragons will have to find us from there, I suppose."
The waiting now graduated into sheer agony. They could not begin to climb down until the acid had eaten itself away into the rock. The salvaged quarter-glass alone kept them on any real sense of time, and the wheeling Southern Cross in the sky above. Twice Lawrence looked, to be sure Turner had not missed the glass running out, only to find it nearly full. Then by an exercise of will he forced himself not to watch, but rather to close his eyes and press his hands against his sides, beneath his arms, for warmth. It was the first week of June, and the night was grown sharply and unexpectedly chill.
"Sir, that's 9,
Turner said softly, at last, and the hissing of the acid had faded. They poked a twig into one of the pitted depressions by the entrance, a good 2 inches deep, and the stick came out unmarked, except for the very end, which smoked a little.
"And his tail hasn't moved, sir?"
Dyer reported in a whisper, meaning the guard dragon up above, after he had put his head out to peer quickly.
"Well, I think it may do,"
Catherine said, when she had cautiously felt around with a rag.
"Mr. Ferris, you may begin. Gentlemen, no more conversation, no calls, no whispers."
Ferris had tied his boots together by their laces and slung them backwards around his neck to keep them out of his way. He tucked a few twists of straw from the floor of the cavern into his waist, then put his head over the side, first, and reached down to feel cautiously around. He looked up and nodded, then swung his leg over. In a moment he vanished, and when Lawrence risked a quick look over the edge, he was already only a darker blot on the surface of the wall 15 feet down, moving with the limber quickness of youth. There was no waving, no calling from below, but their ears were stretched, and Turner had the glass still before him. 15 minutes went, then 20, and no sound of disaster. Chenery's first, Libley, went to the edge and let himself over in similar array, and after him the ensigns and midwing men began to go quicker, 2 and 3 at a time. Lily had sprayed the wall thoroughly, and there were handholds broadly scattered. Chenery went, and a little after him, Catherine with her midwing men drew. Most of the younger aviators had already gone.
"I'll go below you, sir, and guide your feet,"
Martin said very softly, his yellow hair darkened with rubbed-in dirt and water.
"Let me have your boots."
Lawrence nodded silently and handed them over, and Martin tied them up with his own. Martin's hand on his ankle guided his foot to one of the narrow holds, a rough, shallow scrape in the face of the rock which just admitted the grip of his toes, another to the right.
Lawrence eased himself over the edge, groping for handholds beneath the lip. He could not see the face of the cliff beneath him, his own body blocking what little glimmer the stars gave, and could only rely on the sense of touch. The stone cold beneath his cheek, and his breathing very loud in his own ears, with a strange amplified quality of being under water. Blind, deaf, he pressed his body flat as he could against the rock. There was a dreadful moment when Martin touched his ankle again and waited for him to lift it from the cliff. Lawrence thought he would not be able to make himself yield the support. He willed the movement. Nothing happened. Then he took another breath, and at last his foot moved. Martin drawing him gently downward, toes brushing lightly over the rock, to another hold. The second foot, then one hand, then the next, mindlessly. It was easier to continue once he had gone into motion, so long as he did not again allow himself to settle into a fixed position. A slow, deep, bruising ache began between his shoulders and in his thighs. The tips of his fingers burned a little as he went. He did not wonder if it was some trace of the acidic fluids left, or tried not to. He did not trust his grip well enough to wipe them against the rag hanging uselessly from his waistband. Bales, Dulcia's harness man, was near beside him, a little way farther down, a heavy-set man going cautiously. Ground crewmen did not ordinarily go into combat, and had less practice of climbing. He gave, suddenly, a queer, deep grunt, and jerked his hand. Lawrence looked down and saw his face pressed, open-mouthed, into the rock, making a horrible, low, stifled sound, his hand clawing madly at the stone, clawing and coming to shreds. There was white bone gleaming at the fingertips, and abruptly Bales flung out his arm and fell away, his bared teeth clenched and visible for a brief moment. Branches cracked below. Martin's hand was on his ankle, but not moving, a faint tremor. Lawrence did not try to look up, only held to the rock face and breathed, softly, softly. If they were lost, there was nothing to be done. One sweep of a dragon's foreleg would scrape them off the wall. At last they resumed, down again, and to the side. Lawrence caught the gleam of translucent rock at the surface, a vein of quartz, perhaps, on which the venom might have pooled unabsorbed. Some time later, some ages later, a dragon flew by, going quickly through the night. It was well overhead. Lawrence felt its passing only as wind and the sound of wings. His hands were numb with cold and raw. There were pockets of grass beneath his seeking fingers. In a few more steps, a slope, scarcely less than vertical, then a tree root beneath his heel, and they were nearly down. Their feet were in dirt, and the bushes were catching at them. Martin tapped his ankle, and they turned and slithered down on their rumps until they could stand up to put back on their boots. The water could be heard somewhere below, rushing. The jungle, a tangle of palm leaves and tough-skinned vines hanging across their path. A clean, damp smell of moving water, fresh earth and dew, trembling and thick upon the leaves. Their shirts were soon wet through and chill against their skin. A different world entirely than the dusty brown and ochre of the cliffs above. They had all agreed none should wait for long, but go on ahead in small parties, hoping if they were discovered at this stage, at least some might yet escape. Winston, one of his harness men, was waiting a little way on, squatting and rising to stretch out his legs. Also young Alan, nervous and gnawing on the side of his thumb, and his fellow ensign Harley. The five of them went on together, following the course of the cliff wall. The earth was soft, and the vegetation full of juice, compliant. Easier by far to work through than the dry underbrush, if the vines reached up to trip them from time to time. Alan stumbling almost continuously, his latest growth making him gangly and awkward, all long coltish limbs. They could not avoid some degree of noise. They could not cut their way through, but from time to time were forced to haul upon the vines to make enough slack to get through them, with corresponding groans of protest from the branches on which they hung.
"Oh!"
Harley breathed out very softly, frozen. They looked, and eyes looked back, cat-pupiled, bright green. They regarded the leopard, it regarded them. No one moved. Then it turned its head and melted away, solitary and unconcerned. They went on a little faster, still following the channel of the gorge, until at last the jungle thinned out and dredged up to a point where the river's course had divided, and two channels followed separate paths. And he could see through the last stretch of jungle lily and Temeraire waiting there anxiously astride the narrow banks, and squabbling a little.
"But what if you had missed?"
Temeraire was muttering, a little disconsolate and critical, while he stretched his neck to try and peer into the jungle.
"You might have hit the cave-mouth, or some of our crew."
Lily mantled at this suggestion, her eyes very orange.
"I hope I do not need to be nearby to hit a wall,"
she replied quellingly, and then leaned eagerly forward as Harcourt came stumbling down the wet slope towards her.
"Catherine, Catherine, oh, are you well? Is the egg all right?"
"Hang the egg," Catherine said, putting her head against Lily's muzzle.
"No, there, dearest, it has only been a nuisance, but I'm so very glad to see you. How clever you were!"
"Yes," Lily said complacently.
"And indeed it was much easier than I thought it would be. There was no one about to pay any mind except that fellow on the hill, and he was asleep."
Temeraire nuzzled Lawrence gratefully, too, all his quibbling silenced. He still wore the thick iron collar, much to his disgust, and a few clubbed lengths of cable dangling off it, blackened and brittle at the ends, where Lily's acid had weakened the metal enough for the two of them to break it.
"But we cannot leave without Mrs. Erasmus," Lawrence said to him, low.
But Dulcia was landing among them, and Mrs. Erasmus was clutching to the harness on her back. They fled cautiously but quickly homeward, the rich, husbanded countryside providing, Temeraire savage and quick cutting out elephants from a herd, while the smaller herd-dragons yelled angry imprecations, but did not dare give pursuit when he had roared them down. Lily doubling back sharp on herself when a heavyweight roused up in a village on their course and bellowed challenge, to spit with unerring precision at a branch of the great sprawling baobab tree beside him. Her acid sent it crashing down upon his shoulders. He jumped and thought better of giving chase. Looking back, he might be seen gingerly nosing the thick branch, large as an entire tree, away from the clearing. The aviators wove grasses into makeshift cords to tie themselves on with, and pinned their limbs under straps of harness, so that whenever they paused for water they all went down in staggering heaps, pounding on their thighs to drown out the prickling of returning blood. The desert they flew across almost without a pause, pale rock and yellow dust, the curious heads of small animals popping up from holes in the ground in hopes of rain as the dragon shadows passed by like racing clouds. Temeraire had taken all of Dulcia's crew but Chennery himself, and also some of Lily's. The three of them made all the haste which could be imagined, and they broke over the mountains into the narrow coastal province of the settlements in the hour before dawn on the sixth day of flight, and saw the tongues of flame where the cannon at the cape were speaking. Narrow pillars of smoke were lying back against the face of Table Mountain as they came across the bay driving into the city, drifting before a hard wind blowing into the bay, and fires all through the city. Ships beating desperately out of the harbour into the wind, close-hauled as they could go. The cannon of the castle were speaking without cease, thunder-roll of broadsides from the Allegiance in the harbour also, her deck swathed deeply in grey powder-gusts spilling down her sides and rolling away on the water. Maximus was fighting in mid-air above the ship, his sides still gaunt, but the enemy dragons gave him still a wide and respectful berth, and fled from his charges. Massoria and Immortalis flanked him, and Natidus was darting beneath their cover to harry the enemy in their retreat. So far they had preserved the ship, but the position was untenable. They were only trying to hold long enough to carry away those who could be saved, the harbour full of boats, crammed and wallowing boats, trying to get to her shelter. Barclay signalled from Maximus's back as they came on. "Holding well, retrieve company." So they flashed on past and towards the shore where the castle lay under full siege, a vast body of spearmen crouched beneath great shields of oxhide and iron. Many of their fellows lay dead in the fields just before the walls, cut dreadfully apart by canister shot and musketry. Other corpses floated in the moat. They had failed to carry the walls by climbing, but the survivors had withdrawn past the substantial rubble that had been made of the nearby houses by the cannon fire, and now sheltered there from the guns, waiting with terrible patience for a breach in the walls. Another corpse lay dreadfully stretched upon the parade grounds, a yellow and brown dragon, its eyes cloudy and its body half burst upon the ground by impact, a gaping hole torn into its side by the round shot which had brought it down. Scraps of bloody hide stood on the grass even 100 yards distant.
Some 30 dragons more were in the air, now making their passes from very high, dropping not bombs, but sacks of narrow iron blades, flat and triangular, and sharpened along every edge, which drove even into stone. As Temeraire dropped into the courtyard, Lawrence could see them bristling from the earth as if it had been sewed with teeth. There were many dead soldiers upon the heights. King Mokachane was standing on the lower slopes of Table Mountain, clear of cannon shot, observing grimly, and occasionally mantling her wings in yearning when one of the men or dragons were struck. Of course, she was a dragon of no great age, and all instinct would have driven her to the battlefield. There were men hovering around her flanks, and others running back and forth to the company gathered before the fortress walls with orders. Lawrence could not see if the prince was by her side. The city itself had been left untouched. The castle alone bore the attack, although the streets had nevertheless been deserted. Some large boulders lay also strewn in the corners, blood-stained, and others trailing behind them a line of smashed bricks, red under their yellow paint. The soldiers were mostly on the walls, sweating as they worked the guns, and a great crowd of settlers, men and women and children together, huddled in the shelter of the barracks, waiting for the boats to return. Mrs. Erasmus sprang almost at once from Temeraire's back when they had landed, scarcely a hand to the harness. General Grey, hurrying to greet them, looked with astonishment as she went past him without a word.
"She has gone for her children," Lawrence said, sliding down himself. "Sir, we must bring you off at once. The allegiance cannot hold the harbour long."
"But who the devil is she?"
Grey said, and Lawrence realized she must have been quite unrecognizable to him still in her native dress.
"And damn the bloody savages! Yes, we cannot hit a one of those beasts as high as they are keeping, even with pepper-shot. They will have the walls down soon if the place does not catch first. This has not been built to hold against three companies of dragons. Where have they all come from?"
He was already turning, giving orders, his aides running to organize the withdrawal. An orderly, formal retreat. The men spiking their own guns before abandoning them, only a few gun crews at a time, and hurling into the moat the barrels of powder. Mr. Fellows had already gone with the ground crew for the dragon's battle gear, still where it had been stowed, fortunately, in the smithy. They came running with the belly netting and all the spare carabiner straps which they had.
"The armour, sir, we can't manage. Without he come and lift it himself," he said, panting,
as they began in haste to rig Temeraire's belly netting again. And Lily's. Dulcia had gone aloft again, her riflemen armed now with pepper-shot to keep the enemy off their heads at least a little while.
"Leave it!"
Lawrence said. This would be no prolonged struggle, but a quick dash for safety, and back again for more of the men. They needed speed more than the protection of the armour, when the enemy had no guns. Temeraire crouched for the first group of soldiers to climb into the netting, the men stumbling, some pale and sweating with fear, driven by their officers, and others dazed with the noise and smoke. Lawrence now bitterly regretted he had not asked Fellows back in England to rig up some of the Chinese silk carrying harnesses, which would now have allowed them to take many more than the normally allotted number for retreat, 30 for a heavyweight, when by weight Temeraire could have managed 200 or more at a run. They crammed some 50 men in regardless, and hoped the netting would hold for the short flight.
"We will—"
Lawrence began, meaning to say they would return. He was cut short by a shrieked warning from Dulcia, and Temeraire sprang aloft only in time. Three of the enemy, using a netting made of the metal hawsers, had brought overhead an enormous boulder, roughly the size of an elephant, and let fly. It smashed the delicate cup of the bell tower with a sour, ringing clang, and came down through the short passage of the entryway, brick and mortared stone crumbling everywhere, and the portcullis moaned and sagged open to the ground. Temeraire sped to the allegiance to let the men down onto the dragon deck, and as quick hastened back to the shore. The spearmen were coming in through the rubble of the narrow passageway, charging with yells into the teeth of the musket fire Grey had mustered, flooding by and up towards the guns. In parties they were encircling the emplacements yet manned, and stabbing the gun crews to death with quick, short, jerking motions, their spearheads wet and red with blood. One after another the cannon roars silenced, and the dragons overhead began circling like ominous crows, waiting for the last to be stifled so they might descend. Temeraire reared up onto the roof and knocked flat a dozen of the attackers with a swipe of his foreleg, snarling.
"Temeraire, the guns!" Lawrence called. "Smash the guns they have taken!"
The attackers had seized now three cannon not yet spiked, and were trying to turn the first to bring it to bear on the courtyard, where they could fire at Temeraire and Lily.
Temeraire simply put his forehand on the housing and thrust the cannon and the six men clinging onto it through the notched brick battlements. It plunged down and into the moat with a terrific splash, the men undaunted letting go and swimming up through the water. Lily, landing behind them to take on more of the retreat, spat. The second cannon began to hiss and smoke, the barrel thumping to the ground as the wooden housing dissolved quicker than the metal, and went rolling free like a deadly ninepin, knocking men down and spreading the acid everywhere so splatters hissed upon the brick and dirt. The earth beneath them shook so violently, Temeraire stumbled and dropped back to all four legs in the courtyard. Another massive boulder had dropped and smashed a section of the outer walls at the far and undefended end of the courtyard. A fresh wave of men came surging through, quicker than Grey's men could turn to meet them, and charged those still defending the ruined entryway of the castle. The riflemen ranged across Temeraire's back, set up a quick, irregular fire into the onrushing mass. Then the spearmen were in, and grappling furiously with the soldiers and their bayonets, and a strange quiet descended. The guns were scarcely firing any more, and only a scattering of occasional musket and pistol shot broke the soft, grunting noise of panting, struggling men, the groans of the wounded and the dying. All the yard was a great confusion. With no clear avenue of retreat or line of battle, men ran in all directions, now trying to evade, now trying to seek combat, crowded by frightened and bellowing livestock, horses and cows and sheep. These had been brought into the castle, against a siege expected to last longer, and penned in the smaller second courtyard. Maddened by the noise of battle and the dragons wild overhead, they had got loose and now went careening indiscriminately through the grounds, a flock of hens crying around their feet until they broke their legs or necks in flight, or found their way by chance outside the castle grounds. In the crowd, Lawrence caught sight, to his surprise, of Demane, clinging with grim desperation to the collar of the heifer he had been promised, which plunged and bellowed madly against his slight weight. She was dragging him out into the melee while the calf tried to follow, moaning. Sifo hung back in the archway which allowed communication between the two courtyards of the castle, gnawing upon his small bunched fist, his face wrenched with terror, and then with sudden decision dashed out after his brother, his hand reaching for the lead rope which straggled out behind the cow. A pair of soldiers were bayoneting one of the enemy to death savagely as the cow went dragging by. One straightened and wiped blood across his mouth, panting, and shouted, "Fucking little thief! Couldn't wait till we're cold!" Demane saw, let go the cow, and lunged. Sifo went down beneath his protective weight. The bayonet flashed down towards them. There was not even time to call out a protest. The tide of the battle drew the soldiers away in another moment and left the two small bodies huddled on the ground, bloody. The cow stumbled away over the rubble, picking her way out of the courtyard through the open gap in the walls, the calf trotting after her.
"Mr. Martin," Lawrence said, very low.
Martin nodded and tapped Harley on the shoulder. They let themselves down the harness and dashed out across the field. They carried the boys back to be lifted into the netting, Demane limp, Sifo weeping softly against Harley's shoulder, sticky with his brother's blood. A handful of the spearmen had got in among the settlers congregated in the barracks, and a terrible, confused slaughter was under way. The women and children were pushed aside, the attackers sometimes bodily setting them against the walls to put them out of the way, but with no compunction went on laying the men out at their feet, while the settlers fired their muskets and rifles wildly, striking friend and foe alike. The emptied boats were coming back for more passengers, but the sailors at the oars hesitated to pull in, despite the furious swearing of the coxswain, his profanities carrying across the water.
"Mr. Ferris!" Lawrence shouted. "Mr. Riggs! Clear them some space there, if you please!"
And himself slid down to take charge of the loading of the retreating soldiers in Ferris's place. Someone handed him a pistol and a cartridge box, still sticky with the blood of the corpse from which they had come. Lawrence slung it quickly over his shoulder and tore open the paper cartridge with his teeth. He had the pistol loaded and drew out his sword. A spearman came running at him, but he had no opportunity to shoot. Temeraire, catching sight of the threat, cried out his name and lunged to slash the man violently down, dislodging as he did so three of the wavering soldiers trying to get into his netting. Lawrence clenched his jaw and permitted himself to be concealed behind the closed ranks of his ground crew. He handed the pistol forward to Mr. Fellows, and instead went to speed aboard the now desperate men, harried on all sides into the stretching leather of the netting. Lily, who could not take as many, had been loaded already. She lifted away and spat at the flood of men coming in through the ruined wall, filling the empty space with smoking, hideously twisted corpses. But she had to go towards the ship, and the survivors behind at once began to knock down more of the rubble from the walls to bury the remnants of acid.
"Sir,"
Ferris said, panting as he came back. His hand was tucked into his belt, and a gash, brilliant cerise through his shirt, running the length of his arm.
"We have embarked them all, I think. The settlers, I mean, those left."
They had cleared the courtyard, and Temeraire, with more savage work, had killed those manning the guns, although only a few gun crews still laboured, their irregular fire all that still kept off the dragons. The ship's boats were dashing away over the sea, the sailors pulling on the oars with frantic, back-straining haste. The barracks were awash with blood, bodies of black men and white rising and lowering together in the pink-stained froth where the waves were coming in upon the strand.
"Get the general aboard," Lawrence said, "and signal all retreat, if you please, Mr. Turner."
Turning, he offered Mrs. Erasmus his hand to climb aboard. Ferris had escorted her back, and her daughters in their pinafores, dirty and marked with soot, were clinging to her skirts.
"No, Captain, thank you," she said.
He did not understand at first, and wondered if she were injured, if she did not realize the boats had left. She shook her head.
"Gavence is coming. I told him that I would find my daughters and wait for him here in the castle. That is why he let me go."
He stared, bewildered.
"Ma'am," he said, "he cannot pursue us. Not long, not from the shore. If you fear his capturing you again..."
"No,"
she said again, simply.
"We are staying. Do not be afraid for us," she added. "The men will not hurt us. It is dishonor to stain their spears with a woman's blood. And anyway, I am sure Cavense will be here soon."
The Allegiance was already weighing anchor, her guns roaring in fresh vigour to clear her skies to make sail. On the battlements, the last working gun crews had abandoned their posts and were running madly for escape. To Temeraire, to the last boats waiting.
"Lawrence, we must go," Temeraire said, very low and resonant,
his head craning from side to side. His ruff was stretched to its full extent, and even on the ground he was instinctively breathing in long, deep draughts, his chest expanding.
"Lily cannot hold so many of them all alone. I must go help her."
She was all their shelter from the enemy beasts, who were cautious of her acid, having seen its effects now at close range, but they would encircle her and have her down in a moment, or draw her too far aloft so that some of their number could plunge down upon Temeraire while he remained vulnerable upon the ground. More of the men had come pouring into the courtyard through the yielded ground. They were keeping beyond Temeraire's reach, but spreading out along the far wall in a half-circle. Individually they could do no great harm, but by rushing together with their spears might drive Temeraire aloft, and above Lawrence could see some of the dragons skilfully manoeuvring around Lily and into lower positions, ready to receive him onto their claws. There was no time to persuade her. In any case, Lawrence did not think, looking at her face, that she would be easily persuaded.
"Ma'am," he said, "your husband..."
"My husband is dead," she said with finality, "and my daughters will be raised proud children of the Tetswana here, not as beggars in England."
He could not answer. She was a widow and beholden to no one but herself. He had not the right to compel her. He looked at the children holding on to her, their faces gaunt and hollow, too exhausted by extremity even to be afraid any longer.
"Sir, that's everyone,"
Ferris said at his shoulder, looking anxiously between them. She nodded her farewell to Lawrence's silence, and then, bending, lifted up the little girl onto her hip. With a hand on the older girl's shoulder, she guided them towards the shelter of the raised, covered porch of the governor's residence, oddly decorous where it rose out of the bloody wreckage of the battle scattered all around it, and picked her way over the corpses sprawled upon the curving steps. Lawrence said,
"Very well,"
and turning, pulled himself aboard. There was no more time. Temeraire reared up onto his haunches, and roaring, sprang aloft. The dragons scattered in alarm before the divine wind, the nearest crying out shrilly in pain as they fell away, and Lily and Dulcia fell in with him as together they bent away towards the Allegiance, a broad spread of sail white against the ocean, already carrying out of the harbour into the Atlantic.
In the courtyard, the dragons began to land in the ruins to pillage among the cattle running free. Mrs. Erasmus was standing straight-backed at the top of the steps, the little girl clasped in her arms, their faces turned up, and Cefense was arrowing already across the water towards them, calling loud in a joyful voice. Part 3 Chapter 13
"Pray, am I disturbing you?"
Riley said awkwardly. He could not knock because there was no door. There were a great many women aboard, refugee, to the service of whose meagre comfort nearly all the cabins and bulkheads had gone, and a little ragged sailcloth was all which presently divided Lawrence's berth from Chenery's on one side and from Barclay's on the other. "May I ask you to take a turn with me on the dragon deck?" They had already spoken, of course, from necessity, in those first distracted hours, all the officers united in the effort to make some sense of seven dragons, wailing children, wounded men, several hundred inconvenient passengers, and all the confusion which might be expected on a ship three times the size of a first-rate, launched with no preparation directly into a brutal headwind, with a lee shore ready to receive her at any time, and her deck still littered with the large metal-shod stones which had served the enemy for missiles. In the melee, Lawrence had nevertheless seen Riley looking anxiously over the newly arrived company, an anxiety visibly relieved by the sight of Harcourt calling orders to her crew. But another few chances of observation altered his looks of relief to puzzlement, and then to suspicion. Riley had at last come up to the dragon deck on the excuse of requesting the dragons to shift their places to bring the ship a little more by the stern, and so obtained a better view of Catherine's condition. It was just as well that Lawrence had understood what he meant to achieve, for the request, as Riley conveyed it to them, became a confused scheme of putting Maximus at the head of the deck, with Lily apparently on his back, and Temeraire stretched along the port rail, which would likely have ended with half the dragons in the water and the ship turning in stately circles.
"Very willing,"
Lawrence now pronounced himself, and they went above in silence, necessary silence to some extent, as Lawrence had to follow Riley single file through the narrow lanes that were all that was left of navigable space inside and up the ladders. The crammed-in passengers having been given the liberty of the quarter-deck for light and exercise, the dragon deck afforded more privacy than was to be had anywhere else on the ship, so long as one did not mind an interested audience of dragons. These were, in any case, for the moment, mostly inanimate, Temeraire and Lily and Dulcia worn out by their long and desperate flight, as well as the excitement at its end, and Maximus making the forestay hum with the resonance of his deep, sonorous snores. It was just as well they were tired enough to sleep without eating, as there was little to be had, nor would be again until the ship could put in at some port for resupply. When they woke, they would have to fish for their supper.
"I am afraid," Riley said diffidently, breaking their silence as they walked along the railing, "that we may have to water at Benguela. I regret it very much, if it should give you any pain. I am considering whether we ought not to try for St. Helena instead."
St. Helena was not a slave port, and out of their way. Lawrence was deeply sensible of the degree of apology embodied in this offer, and immediately said,
"I do not think it can be recommended. We could easily find ourselves blown to Rio on the easterlies, and even though both the cure and the word of the loss of the Cape must precede us home, our formation must still be needed urgently back in England."
Riley as gratefully received this gesture in return, and they walked several passes up and down the deck, much more comfortably together.
"Of course, we cannot lose a moment," Riley said, "and for my own part I have reason enough to wish us home again as quickly as we might go, or thought I did, until I realized she meant to be obstinate. But, Lawrence, I beg you will forgive me for speaking freely. I would be grateful for a headwind all the way, if it meant we should not arrive before she has married me."
The other aviators had already begun referring, in uncharitable terms, to what they viewed as Riley's quixotic behavior, Chenery going so far as to say, "If he will not leave off harassing poor Harcourt, one will have to do something. But how is he to be worked on?" Lawrence had rather more sympathy for Riley's plight. He was a little shocked by Catherine's refusal to marry, rather than burn, when the plain choice was put before her, and he was forcibly reminded to regret Reverend Erasmus, for the lack of what he was sure would have been that gentleman's warm and forceful counsel in favour of the marriage. Mr. Britton, Riley's official chaplain, assigned by the Admiralty,
could not have brought a moral argument to bear on anyone, even if he were made sober long enough to do so. "But at least he is ordained," Riley said. "So there would be no difficulty about the thing whatsoever. Everything would be quite legal. But she will not hear of it, and she cannot say, in fairness," he added half-defiantly, "that it is because I am some sort of scoundrel. Because I did not try to speak before, it was not as though I was not the one who—" Then, cutting himself off hastily, instead ended more plaintively by saying, "And I did not know how to begin. Lawrence, has she no family who might prevail on her?"
"No, quite alone in the world," Lawrence said. "And Tom, you must know that she cannot leave the service. Lily cannot be spared."
"Well," Riley said reluctantly, "if no one else can be found to take the beast on," a notion of which Lawrence did not bother to try and disabuse him, "but it does not matter. I'm not such an outrageous scrub as to abandon her, and the governor was kind enough to tell me that Mrs. Gray is perfectly willing to receive her, generous beyond what anyone might expect, and it would surely make everything easy for her in England. They have a large acquaintance in the best circles, but of course not until we are married, and she will not listen to reason."
"Perhaps she fears the disapproval of your family,"
Lawrence said, more from a motive of consolation than conviction. He was sure Catherine had not given a thought to the feelings of Riley's family, nor would have, if she had determined on the marriage. "I have already promised her that they would do all that is proper, and so they would," Riley said. "I do not mean to say it is the sort of match they would have looked out for me, but I have my capital and can marry to please myself, without any accusation of imprudence, at least. I dare say that my father at least will not care two pins, if only it is a boy. My brother's wife has not managed anything but girls the last 4 years ago, and everything entailed," he finished, very nearly flinging up his hands. "But it is all nonsense, Lawrence," Catherine said, equally exasperated when he approached her. "He expects me to resign the service."
"I believe," Lawrence said, "that I have conveyed to him the impossibility of such a thing. And he is reconciled to the necessity, if not pleased by it. And you must see," he added, "the very material importance of the circumstance of the entailment."
"I do not see at all," she said. "It is something to do with his father's estate. What has it to do with me or the child? He has an older brother, has he not, with children?" Lawrence, who had not so much been instructed in the legal structures of inheritance and entailment as absorbed them through the skin, stared. And then he hastily made her understand that the estate would descend in the male line, and her child, if a boy, stood to inherit after his uncle.
"If you refuse, you deny him his patrimony," Lawrence said, "which I believe likely to be substantial, and entailed in default on a distant relation who would care nothing for the interest of Riley's nieces."
"It is a stupid way of going on," she said, "but I do see. And I suppose it would be hard luck on the poor creature if he grew up knowing what might have been. But all I am hoping for is not a boy at all, but a girl. And then what use is she to him, or I?" She sighed and rubbed the back of her hand across her brow, and finally said, "Oh, bother. I suppose he can always divorce me. Very well, but if it is a girl, she will be a Harcourt," she added with decision. The marriage was briefly postponed for want of anything suitable to make a wedding feast until they had managed some resupply. Already extremity had driven them to shore on several occasions. There was no safe harbour on their charts along the southern coastline where the Allegiance might have safely put in, so instead the empty water casks were roped together and draped upon the dragons who daily flew in the 20 miles of open water which Riley's caution left between them and the coast and tried to find some nameless river emptying into the sea. Drawing near Benguela, they passed a pair of tattered ships on the 15th of June, with blackened sides and makeshift, slovenly sails a pirate would have been ashamed to rig, which they took for fellow refugees from the Cape, choosing to make east for St. Helena. The Allegiance did not offer to heave to. They had no water or food to spare of their own, and in any case the smaller ships ran away from them, likely fearing to be pressed either for supplies or men, not without cause. "I would give a good deal for 10 able seamen," Riley said soberly, watching them go hull up over the horizon. He did not speak of what he would give for a proper dole of clean water. The dragons were already licking the sails in the morning for the dew, all the company having been put on half-rations. They saw the smoke first, still rising, from a long way off, a steady ongoing smoulder of damp wood piled into massive bonfires, which, as they drew nearer the harbour, resolved themselves into the overturned hulks of ships, which had been dragged from the ocean onto the beach. Little more than the stout keels and futtocks remained, like the rib cages of beached leviathans who had flung themselves onto the sands to die. The fortifications of the Dutch factory had been reduced to rubble. There was no sign of life. With all the gun ports open and the dragons roused and alive to the least warning of danger, the ship's boats went to the shore full of empty water casks. They came back again, pulling more quickly despite their heavier load. In Riley's cabin, Lieutenant Wells reported uneasily.
"More than a week, sir, I should say," he said. "There was food rotting in some of the houses, and all that is left of the fort is perfectly cold. We found a large grave dug in the field behind the port. There must have been at least 100 dead."
"It cannot have been the same band who came on us in Cape Town," Riley said, when he had done. "It cannot. Could dragons have flown here so quickly?"
1,400 miles in less than a week's time? Not if they meant to fight at the end of it, and very likely not at all," Catherine said, measuring upon the map with her fingers.
She had the chair, as Riley had managed to carry the point of giving her the large, stern cabin for the journey home.
"They needn't have, at any rate. There were dragons enough at the falls to make another raiding party of the same size, or another 10, for that matter."
"Well, and I'm sorry to sound like a damned ill-wishing crow," Chenery said, "but I don't see a blessed reason why they shouldn't have gone for Luanda while they were at it."
Another day's sailing brought them in range of the second port. Dulcia and Nitidus set off, beating urgently before the wind, and some 8 hours later returned again, finding the Allegiance in the dark by the beacons lit in the tops.
"Burnt to the ground, the whole place,"
Chenery said, tipping back the cup of grog which had been given him thirstily.
"Not a soul to be seen, and all the wells full of dragon shit. Beg your pardon."
The magnitude of the disaster began gradually to dawn upon them all. Not only Cape Town lost, but two of the largest ports in Africa besides. If the enemy's purpose had been to seize control of the ports, all the intervening territory must have first been conquered. But if simple destruction were all their desire, no such long-drawn-out labour was required. Without aerial forces to oppose them, the dragons could overfly with ease any defences or mustered force and go directly to their target, carrying their light infantry with them, and then expend all their energy upon the hapless town which had incurred their wrath.